Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
And so that was about the time I met Laura. And she was really nice. We hit it off. We were really good friends.
How old were you then?
Her twin sister. I was 18.
Uh-huh, okay.
Her twin sister, paternal twins, not identical, started dating one of my good friends in the congregation. Their congregation was about 90 miles away from ours. And then one of her friends started dating another one of my friends in my congregation. So us three guys in Sioux Falls, we're all kind of seeing these girls up in Marshall, Minnesota. And I never really considered it to be a romantic thing. I just thought they were cool and we were hanging out with them. But then, you know, eventually we started breaking off into, you know, couples, and Laura and I were a couple. And it was before I even realized what was going on. And of course, you're not allowed to date in the religion unless you're dating somebody that you plan to marry.
Okay.
So they call it dating with a view to marriage.
Uh-huh.
And so her family was very adamant that I express my desire to marry her if I was going to continue to see her. And at that point I was just like, no, she's cool. Like, we go roller skating together, but, like, you know, I just didn't really see it on that level. But at the same time, I didn't really have any other friends. And so I was like, all right, I guess, you know, let's date. And within 9 months, we were married. So I was 19 when we got married. She had just turned 21.
Is that common to get married that young among Jehovah's Witnesses?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, you can't have sex before marriage. And, you know, all these kids are ready to burst. And so they know their only out is to get married. And so they do. And I would say the majority of marriages in the Kingdom Halls are in the early 20s range.
Okay.
Yeah, we got married, and the congregation, the Sioux Falls congregation that we were in, decided that a lot of the members in the congregation were against us getting married because they thought we were too young, which they, you know, they were right, but, you know, for different reasons. So because of that, they wouldn't accept Laura in the congregation. So she wouldn't, no one would speak to her after the meetings. She was pretty much by herself. And so we left a lot of meetings with her crying and not understanding why no one liked her and that whole thing. And so we lasted about 3 months with that. And then we finally decided to move to Marshall, where her family was. And then the congregation up there was very accepting. But, you know, we ran into problems with her brother, who was an elder in the congregation. And he's kind of a mental case. You know, and there's a lot of minutiae in there that, you know, it just doesn't. You know, I guess, like, one good example would be I worked for her brother at his shop. He had a cleaning supply store.
Uh-huh.
And I guess one day $5 went missing. And so he assumed I stole it. And we were sitting at home, and him and two other elders show up, and they come into the house, and basically it's an ad hoc, like, judicial committee. And I'm looking around going, like, wait, what's going on here? This is not how this works. I've been through this before. This is not how this goes. And, you know, because, I mean, technically he would not have been allowed to be involved in it because he was the aggrieved party. It was a mess. Laura was freaking out. She was crying. She had no idea what was going on. He was accusing me of stealing money from him. I kept telling him I hadn't stolen the money. There was no real proof, but he just, because he said I had done it, then I had done it. And so I was like, I just want you out, so fine. Here's $5. And I gave him $5. And so then he read the scripture in Deuteronomy that talks about if a stealer steals, that he should pay back four times what he stole. And I'm like, I looked at him like, so you want me to give you a 20? Is that what you're telling me? And he's like, I'm not telling you that. Jehovah's telling you that. And I was like, okay, if it'll get you out of my house, here's a $20 bill. Like, just leave, please. And so I think as an adult, these kind of things happening were more of like a, you know what? And I kind of adopted a more of an FU attitude towards it. Like, you know, get over yourselves. And so I started kind of, I was starting to go into the fringe territory. Like, I was still a witness. I was still going to the meetings. I really wasn't going out in service that much. I was just kind of doing whatever because I was kind of over it. And Laura and I didn't have much of a relationship because, you know, as a gay man, I wasn't attracted to her. And yeah. So we weren't having sex except for when she'd get so insistent that it was like, okay, fine. And I would try to get through it. And it was, you know, I think I can count on my hand the number of times that we had vaginal sex throughout 18 years of marriage. We literally just would masturbate each other and be done with it. And I was okay with that because I could close my eyes and fantasize about something else. But I couldn't actually engage in actual sex with her because I couldn't do it. So
you guys really weren't having normal sexual intercourse, and you weren't having kids then? Or did you have kids?
No, never had kids.
Uh-huh.
You know, that destroyed her self-esteem. Because, yeah. You know, here she is married to a man, and she's been trained to think that... Because that's another aspect to the JW teaching, is that women are constantly being encouraged to make sure that they give their husband their due, you know, which is a scripture from Corinthians. And, you know, meaning that they give him sex on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And so much so that if, say, as a husband, I went out and cheated on my wife... Yeah. And I came and I got caught and I was brought up on adultery charges. I could tell the elders, and if I was able to convince them that it was the case, that she hadn't been providing sex at home, it wouldn't make me not guilty, but it would make her guilty of it as well. So the adultery charge that I'd be facing, my wife would then be facing that as well because she did not give me her due.
Okay.
So she's been raised to think that, like, you know, I'm going to want a lot of sex. And so I'm not wanting any sex, and in fact, I'm pushing it away. That just tells her that I don't find her attractive. And so she was overweight. She was, you know, she had some issues with cleanliness. She was suffering from massive depression. It was just, like, horrible. I mean, we had the first 7 years of our marriage were so bad that there were times when I was actually, like, trying to think of ways where I, you know, like, could I die in an accident? Like, I knew I couldn't commit suicide, but could I die in an accident or something, you know, because I just had to find a way out of it. So finally we moved to Blue Earth, Minnesota. I was working close to 100 hours a week trying to make a living. We had bought a house. We were underneath it. We, you know, that we'd spend weeks or months without electricity because we couldn't afford the bill, you know, stupid stuff like that. And I wasn't going to meetings anymore because, honestly, I was just too tired. I didn't have the time or the energy anymore. The congregation, we had a couple of close friends in the congregation, but for the most part, they didn't really have much to do with us because we weren't active. We were what they consider inactive.
Yeah.
And so occasionally the elders would pop in and say, hey, what's going on? Why aren't you going to meetings? But for the most part, we were on our own. And when I was working at the factory, I met a guy there who was into computers, and this was like 1996. He was into computers. He wanted, you know, and he wanted me to get into computers. And so I had purchased a computer, and he used to bring his computer over. We'd play like NASCAR on it. We'd link the two together. And so I kind of reinvigorated my love of computers, which I had, you know, growing up. And he was like, you should go to school. And I was like, oh, no, like, I could never go to school. Like, that's not allowed. And he's like, you should go to school, dude. Like, you know about computers, and you could get a job doing stuff that's not at a factory. And, you know, and he encouraged me to go back to school, which I did. I ended up going to college, got my computer programming degree, and then started working for IBM. And this is about 98 now. And at that point, I was driving 2 hours one way to work every day. And so a lot of times I would just stay in Rochester for a few days instead of driving back and forth. So Laura and I started spending less time together. I really wasn't living at the house. Even when I would come back and be in town, I would get a hotel because I couldn't stay in the house as filthy as it was. And I eventually decided I wanted to move to California. So Laura and I came out here to visit my old stomping grounds. We stayed with my brother for a week who was living out here. And I made the decision to move out here, and we separated. And I, because she was like, I don't want to move to California. And I'm like, that's fine. I don't really want you to come anyway. I'm going without you. And so we separated for about 9 months.
Uh-huh.
And then she finally called me and was like, you know, I'm lonely and I think I want to live out there. And so she moved out here and it was much better because the depression went away. The congregation was more accepting. We got really active in the congregation again, you know. Uh-huh. And I mean, throughout this whole period of time, I am so far repressed and in the closet that I've uh-huh. almost forgotten that I'm gay. I labeled myself as asexual, that I wasn't interested in sex, you know, even though I was masturbating like 2 or 3 times a day. You know, I had convinced myself I just didn't want to have sex with anybody else. But when we came out to California, the congregation was more accepting. They were more encouraging. We got really, really involved. Within a year, Laura started pioneering. Then I started pioneering. We started learning Mandarin Chinese in the congregation. We joined the Chinese group, this foreign language group in our hall, because our area had a lot of Chinese people that we were witnessing to. And then at the same time, I was doing web design, web development. And so I had an office set up at my house. I was working out of the house. And I had discovered gay porn. And I was watching a lot of gay porn, which would allow me to get through sexual activity with Laura. And so we were having more sex because I'd spend an hour watching gay porn and get all riled up and then go in and power through it. And, you know, she was like, yay. Okay. And so, like, everything was better. She didn't know I was watching porn. She just thought I was coming in and wanting to have sex with her.
Okay.
So everything was going better, but it was still, like, it was whatever.
It was a little bit fake.
Yeah, it was not a real life at all. And that went on for, you know, that we moved out here in 2001. So all the way through like 2009, everything was, or 2007, 2008, I guess.
Uh-huh.
At that point, I was a ministerial servant in the congregation, which is the equivalent of like a deacon, I guess. I don't know what the Mormons would refer to that as. But it,
yeah, for us deacons are youth, but yeah, I don't know what
basically.
The might be.
Yeah, basically, a ministerial servant in the congregation is somebody who is being trained to be an elder, but uh-huh. isn't an elder, and they handle a lot of the administrative duties in the congregation. So, like, I handled the accounts for the congregation. So, you know, after all the meetings, I collected the money out of the contribution boxes. I would count it and make the deposits in the bank and submit accounts reports every month. I also handled the literature and the magazines. So I would, like, the shipments of magazines and literature to the congregations would come to me. I would unpack them and load them into the counters. People would come to me when they wanted books and magazines. And then I also did the sound, the PA system and running the mics and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So that's what ministerial servants did in the congregation.
Uh-huh.
I also gave public talks at other congregations. So I'd go and give the public talk on Sunday occasionally. And then because I was in the Chinese group and there weren't any brothers who could speak Chinese, I would conduct the watchtower in the Chinese group every week.
Okay.
So we were super busy.
Yeah.
Like, our life was 100% revolving around the congregation, pioneering, all this stuff. But one of the elders in the hall decided that he was going to make it his life's mission, him and his family. Who I'd gotten really close to his daughter and her husband and their 5 kids, to the point where I had the ability to go to the kids' school and take them out of school on my own word whenever I wanted. And so sometimes I'd go to the school and take them all out and take them to Disneyland for the day. You know, and I had that authority with the school, like I was on the list. That's okay. How close we were to their family. But the mother was a little bit psychotic. The father was kind of a narcissist, and I don't know if I wasn't giving them the whatever they needed, but they decided to, they were just going to destroy my life. And they started by ending the relationship with us, which, you know, I took really hard because I missed the kids. I missed being with them. They were the first people that I ever really emotionally opened up to, because most of my relationships throughout my entire life were always just kind of surface. And I'd never uh-huh. really been emotionally attached to anybody. And I'd kind of opened myself up emotionally to these people. And, you know, they just, for seemingly no reason at all, decided we weren't friends anymore.
Did you find out later why they decided to do that, or did you never find out?
Yeah, eventually I realized that there was another couple involved, which was a younger couple. Angie and Scott were like 40-some years old. They were the ones with the five kids. Then it was Laura and I, and we were in our 30s, you know, early 30s at the time. And then there was Ashley and Travis, and Ashley was 8 or 9 years younger than me, and Travis was her high school sweetheart, but he was worldly. And so Ashley and I went to Pioneer School together, which is when you regular Pioneer the first year, at the end of the first year, you're invited to go to this 2-week Pioneer School. And they're held locally, and so, you know, it's not like you have to travel for it, but you spend 2 weeks in intensive Bible study, and they, you know, call it Pioneer School. But Ashley came with me to Pioneer School. We went to the same one. And so we'd kind of bonded there. And so she came up to me after that and was like, hey, can you study with this guy? Like, I know him from school, and he kind of, like, asks me Bible questions. And it's annoying because I don't really like him. But, you know, if he's interested, you know, whatever. And what she wasn't telling me is that they were dating, and she wanted to marry him, but she wouldn't be able to unless he was a witness. And so he studied with me, got baptized, and then they were going to get married. And so because there's a special relationship that gets formed when you bring someone into the truth, as they say, I'll put quotes around that. And so he kind of got integrated into our life as well as her. They would hang out with us and with Scott and Angie and whatever. And, you know, Scott and Angie were both the ideal looking kind of people. Scott was very big and muscular and man's kind of man. And Angie was very small and very petite, very pretty, as were Travis and Ashley. Travis and Ashley were almost like replicas of Scott and Angie as far as looks go, just 20 years earlier. And whereas Laura and I were both overweight, I've never really cared about what clothes I wear. You know, I wear shorts and t-shirts. That's kind of my life. So we weren't fashion conscious, that kind of thing. And so basically Angie decided that hanging out with Laura was taking away from men looking at them when they were out. Like, she wanted guys to be staring at her and Ashley, and that wouldn't happen if Laura was there, because Laura was this big rhinoceros. That was the way she put it. And so they just decided that Laura was not going to be around anymore. They didn't want Laura in the picture. And so they liked me because I took the kids off their hands. They never had to worry about their kids because I was always out doing stuff with the kids. Because, you know, I mean, I never really had a childhood. And so I still, like, when I'm around a kid, I kind of get into that same mode where I just like being a kid. And so they got along with me and I got along with them. And I'd take them to the park and play baseball with them and do all this stuff. And so I was basically a full-time babysitter for them.
Yeah.
And so, but when I realized that when they were cutting Laura out, I got defensive and was like, what the hell's going on? And they kind of maneuvered the situation into pushing me into a corner so that I would say something that I shouldn't have, which basically was that I cussed out Angie because I was mad. And because of that, we were no longer friends. And that's how they ended the friendship. And so we dealt with all that. Meanwhile, her dad, as an elder in the congregation, is putting me up on charges like every other week. I'm always getting pulled into the back room, which is a way of saying that you're getting in trouble. There's always a back room in every kingdom hall, and that's where the elders take you when they want to counsel you.
Okay. You're saying this was Angie's dad?
Angie's father, yes, who was an elder in the congregation.
Okay.
And, you know, I'd get pulled into the back room, and they'd be like, okay, well, we have reports that you did this. And it's like, well, no, I didn't do that. And they're like, well, we have reports that you did. It's like, well, I didn't, though, so... And they're like, okay, well, you know, we'll have to go back. But it was like every week it was something new and something stupid. And you know, and it just got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. To the point where Richard, the elder, was calling special elder meetings and bald-faced lying about stuff and making stuff up. And I kept begging the other elders, like, can you please do something about this? Can you please remove him from being an elder? Like, he's lying, he's slandering, he's doing all these things that should, by all rights, get him removed from the congregation. You know, he's making it impossible for me to be a member of this congregation. It was like the emotional, like, strain was so strong that I would leave the meetings sometimes, and I'd sit in my car and I'd just, like, start bawling my eyes out because I was I was so stressed out, and I couldn't understand why it was happening. And the other elders were just, they would always tell me, like, well, just wait on Jehovah. Wait on Jehovah. You know, we really can't do anything about it. You just got to wait on Jehovah. And it took 3 years before a circuit overseer, and side note, a circuit overseer is somebody who is manages an entire circuit of congregations, usually about 12 or 13, and he visits each one every 6 months.
Uh-huh.
And so he comes in and basically, like, makes sure the elders are doing what they're supposed to do, that the numbers, basically it's a numbers thing. You know, how many people are active, how many people are inactive, what's your meeting attendance like based on the number of publishers you have, you know, what's your average service time across the entire congregation, how many magazines are you placing? That's okay. What he deals with. I had talked to about three circuit overseers about the situation as the years had gone by. And finally, one of them did something about it, and he was removed. And I felt like it was over finally. I was like, okay, I can finally kind of get back to getting my life in order again. Well, that just set Angie off. When her dad got removed as an elder, she blamed me. And probably, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say it was my fault, but, it, you know, I was certainly leading the charge to have that happen. And so she stepped up her campaign in a big way. To the point where she finally just, she dropped a nuke and walked in one day and said that I was molesting the kids. And that was like, obviously, that was a huge issue. It blew up. It went all the way up to the legal department of the society in New York. And it was finally established that she had set a pattern of being dishonest when it came to me. And so clearly nothing had happened and they just let it go. And then after that, Scott and Angie moved halls. They picked up and left because they felt like they weren't getting their way here. So they moved to a congregation where Angie's brother-in-law was an elder, you know, because if she always felt like if she had an elder in her pocket in the congregation, she could do whatever she wanted, which was an accurate assumption. So then that was when I finally was like, okay, this is finally over. Like, these people are gone. Richard's gone. Like, I'm finally going to be able to, like, get my life back. And unfortunately, no. I got pulled into the back room again, and at this point I was like, I was really over it. I was over it all. I didn't even wear a suit that night. I showed up in shorts and a beer t-shirt. At the time I was doing my beer show New Brew Thursday with some worldly people. The elders had a huge problem with me doing that show. They thought it was completely inappropriate. I wasn't going to acquiesce because I knew there was nothing scripturally or organizationally wrong with me doing the show. But they just didn't like it, so they were really pushing that. So they pulled me back and they said, you know, we want to talk to you about a couple of things. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, well, we have some reports that you've been watching a lot of R-rated movies and that you've been cussing and swearing a lot and that you've been encouraging other people in the congregation to watch R-rated movies. And I'm like, no, none of that's true. And I mean, I used to watch R-rated movies, but it was like here and there and whatever. Now, bear in mind that for the average rank and file member of the congregation, watching R-rated movies is kind of a conscience thing. I mean, the elders will tell you you shouldn't do it, but if you're a ministerial servant or an elder, it's not allowed. And if it's found out that you're watching them, you get removed as a servant or an elder, and that's the end of it. So then they brought up the beer show, which I was like, we had already dealt with the beer show with the circuit overseer, which trumps the elders, you know, and the circuit overseer had said that there was nothing wrong with it and that they should let it go and not have it be an issue. And so I brought that up. I'm like, you know, we already talked about this with the circuit overseer. Why are we talking about this again? It's like, and they were like, well, we don't agree with what he had to say about it. And this is our congregation. And so we're telling you that you can't do the beer show anymore. And I'm like, well, I'm gonna, so I don't really know where we're going with that. And so then they were like, okay, well, you know, your attitude's really not good anymore. We've noticed a really steep decline in your attitude in the last couple of years. And so it's really made us decide, like, we're going to have a meeting to discuss whether you're still qualified to serve as a servant. And I just lost it. You know, it was like I had been tormented and persecuted and beaten emotionally for 3.5 years by an elder on their body who was lying and slandering and doing all sorts of things. And not just to me, but to other people in the congregation. Like, I wasn't his only target. There were a few other targets there. And everyone knew him to be that way, and they wouldn't do anything about it. And yet now they're coming after me because I do a beer show and I have a bad attitude. And I was like, really? Aren't we going to wait on Jehovah for another 4 years? Like, I mean, that's what you kept telling me to do, is wait on Jehovah, wait on Jehovah. It's like, but now all of a sudden I have a bad attitude, and so you're jumping on this. Like, we're going to get you removed. And I started laughing. I was sitting in the room, and I just started laughing. And one of the elders looked at me, and he's like, well, I don't understand what you find funny. And I'm like, this is funny. I go, you guys are funny. This whole, like, situation is hilarious. And I go, and let me explain something to you. I go, I am done. I am done with this 100%. And I stood up and I grabbed my Bible. I told them both to F off. I flipped them both off with with both hands. And I walked out. And I never went back again. And that was it. It was like, I was done. I had nothing more to say to them. I had no interest in being there anymore. And it was almost like a switch got flipped, where it was just like, nope, this is obviously not directed by God. Like, I was like, there is no direction of Holy Spirit here. No supernatural being that I want to have anything to do with is taking part with any of this crap. And so I went out that night. I had a couple of beers, and I went home and told my wife what had happened. And, you know, we had been fighting, and she had started working out at the gym, and she had a personal trainer, and she was really emotionally attached to her personal trainer, who was a guy. So I used that hardcore. I was like, this relationship is inappropriate. You know, you're cheating on me with Brad, like all this stuff. And I finally was like, look, we only stayed married because of the religion. And since I'm not in the religion anymore, do you want to stay married? And she was like, no, not really. And I was like, all right.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I packed up and moved out in November of 2010. And that was it. It was like, I was out of the congregation. I had separated from Laura. I moved out to Riverside from the Artesia area. And I just focused on the craft beer side of things that I was doing. Like, I had gotten really into the craft beer community.
Your life got turned over upside down anyway, huh?
Yeah, it was like, and fortunately, I had a lot of friends who were not witnesses, who were very supportive of my leaving the religion. I had people that I could hang out with. It wasn't like I was alone. And I didn't get disfellowshipped or anything. I wasn't punished. I wasn't removed. And so my witness friends, you know, they just were like, oh, Steve's having a hard time, and he'll be back, and it's fine. And they would still talk to me, and they would still call me up and say, hey, you know, miss you at the meetings, whatever. But after about 3 months, Laura called me up, and she, you know, we had been having on and off fights and this and that over money, because, you know, she had never had to really work, and now she was responsible for the finances for the place. And, you know, I was trying to help her as much as I could, but it was kind of a weird situation. And so she was having problems, and, she finally called me up, and she's like, you know, I want to talk. And so we met up, and she's like, you know, I miss you, and I've been doing a lot better with the housework, and I'm not I'm willing to stop training with Brad, and I'm willing to get a different personal trainer. And, you know, like, she was all these things that I had been using for the entire 18 years that we had been together. She was trying to tell me, like, I've been working on it really hard, I'm going to do better. And I was like, oh, she wants to get back together. Like, awkward. Yeah. And it was at that moment, like, you know, cause I had been thinking about it over the few months that I was out, that, like, you know, obviously I'm watching a lot of gay porn, so obviously I want to be with a guy. So it was like I almost had to remember that I was gay when I left. And it kind of came back up again, like, oh, I can be gay again. But I didn't come out, and I never did anything. And I had never cheated on Laura in the entire time that we were together. But I reached out and grabbed her hand, and I said, Laura, it's none of this matters. It's not you. I'm gay. And that's it. This has never been about you. This has been about the fact that I'm not attracted to women. And I'm really sorry that I put you through 18 years, but that's, you know, that's what was required of me. And she stared out the window for a few minutes, and you could just see, like, she was processing, like, all 18 years of our marriage. And she finally just looked at me, and she says, thank you for finally telling me that. She goes, everything makes so much more sense now. Yeah. And I was like, okay, that's good. And I'm like, are you upset? And she's like, no, I feel bad for you. And I'm sorry that you had to live that way. I hope that you can be happy. And, you know, we went our separate ways. And it was like, it was finally like this division had finally been placed in front of us that says, we're never going to have this relationship again, period. Now we can be friends. And so we're actually very close friends now. You know, we talk on a regular basis and we hang out occasionally when, you know, we can. And so, you know, we finally have the relationship that we should have had, you know, 20 years ago when we were kids. We should have just been friends, right. You know. That was a positive for that.
I mean, that's nice that she was able to also find a place. I mean, it sounds like she was making some of those improvements for maybe the wrong reasons, but hopefully it helped her to move on and actually do something else with her life. I mean, I don't want to get into her story too much, but...
Well, yeah, no, and I won't, other than to say that her self-esteem skyrocketed. She lost over 100 pounds. She became a personal trainer herself. She's now a trail marathon runner.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, she lives a completely different life now. And she has, like, I don't know this woman anymore. She's not the woman I was married to. She's a completely different person who is so much more in control of her life and has so much more power and confidence and is such a great person to be around now versus what she was when she... Because she hasn't left the religion the way I did, but she hasn't been to a meeting since we separated. So, I mean, she's as out as I am, and all of her friends are worldly. She has her own life. You know, she doesn't really have anything to do with the congregation anymore. She faded out better than I did. And that's another, like, terminology that we use to kind of, like, when you escape without drawing any lines, you fade out. And then you're just kind of inactive. Nobody really – there's no hard lines drawn about whether people can talk to you or not. It's just that you just don't go to meetings anymore.
Because the people who are disfellowshipped really are shunned, in other words.
Yeah, you are completely shunned when you're disfellowshipped, or if you disassociate yourself. Or in my case, because after that conversation with Laura, I really wanted to pursue my sexuality. Like, I wanted to figure out where I was with that. Was I really gay? Did I just have an attraction to men? Like, if it came down to actually having a sexual relationship with a man, would I be able to do that? Or would it freak me out? Or, you know, like, because I didn't really know. But at the same time, I still believed in this religion. I still believed in God. I still believed in the Bible. And I still believed that being a homosexual was not something that God would approve of. And so I had to figure out for myself where that was before I was going to do anything. And so I spent the next year, I read the Bible cover to cover twice. I read-ish the Quran. It was really hard to read. And so a lot of it just kind of got skimmed. But then I started doing a lot of research on, like, you know, evolution, origin of life stuff. One topic in particular that really caught my interest was the flood. And so... Uh-huh. Jehovah's Witnesses teach that the flood is a literal account in the Bible, that it actually happened exactly the way the Bible says that it did, and that 4,000 years ago, all life on this planet was wiped out, save eight people and about 15,000 animals.
Lots of critters.
Right.
Pairs.
So
yeah.
I chose that topic to say, okay, I'm going to do the research on it scientifically. Is something like that possible? Could it have possibly happened? And it took about 30 minutes. to figure out that no, 4,000 years ago, all life on this planet was not wiped out, and that did not happen at all. So that was a big blow to me. Like, wow, so they have this wrong. Like, what else do they have wrong? And so I reread in the 80s, they released a book called Life, How Did It Get Here by Creation or Evolution. And I reread that book, but this time I read it from the standpoint of doing the research on it myself. So anytime they would reference a scientist or quote a scientist, I would look that quote up on the internet. And did this scientist actually say that? And if he did say that, why did he say it? What was the context of what he was saying? And in 90% of the quotes in that book were either fabrications, intentionally misquoted, or were by scientists who were actually Jehovah's Witnesses and they didn't say that. And so I was like, well, this seems like really dishonest. This is extremely misleading. And in fact, apparently one of the scientists was upset enough about it that he had like tried to sue them or something like that for like misrepresenting them. So then I looked at their newer publications on creation versus evolution, and it was a very similar situation. All of their pseudoscience that they purport in there is either made up or is from scientists, and I'm going to put that in air quotes for the listeners, who are actually Jehovah's Witnesses and not actually peer-reviewed scientists. Okay. And that was a big thing for me. It's like you can't say something and say that, oh, well, this scientist says this and it's true unless it's been peer-reviewed or, you know, actually published or is legitimately recognized as being valid in the scientific community. And none of what's in their brochures about creation is scientifically accepted. So I finally, like, I sent my mom, as much as we didn't have a relationship throughout most of my life anyway, the one thing I did always appreciate about her was that she was very scientifically minded. You know, she always wanted to know stuff. She always did a lot of reading and research, and I always respected that. And so I sent her an email and was basically like, look, I've been doing this reading. I've been doing this research because I really want to know, like, what is the truth? Like, is this the truth? Is it not the truth? Is there a God? Is there not a God? Whatever. And I'm like, how do you rectify these things? And at the end, and it wasn't an accusation necessarily. It was just like, why would the governing body, which is the seven guys in New York who write all the doctrine for the Jehovah's Witnesses, intentionally push a creationist agenda by using, you know, dishonest means? Like, why can't they prove this honestly? And because I asked that question, I was labeled an apostate, and the very next day, my entire family disowned me. My brother blocked me on Facebook. I got a text message from my sister telling me that I was not welcome to call her, that she wanted nothing to do with me in the future. I had plans to spend a week with my parents in South Dakota following a beer event that I had to go to in Omaha for the show. And I was told by my parents that I wouldn't be welcome to stay there. And because of the way the travel arrangements were made, I still had to go to South Dakota. So I got to spend 4.5 days sitting in a hotel room watching TV, waiting to leave South Dakota because I had no other reason to be there except to see my parents, who wouldn't have anything to do with me. And so,
and by this time, your father had joined the religion?
Yes, yeah. Thank you. I totally spaced that off. After 40 years, as I was leaving, he started studying and was baptized the month before I left. October 2011, he started studying in October when I left. But October 2011, he was baptized after not being a witness for 40 years. And so it was actually him who led the charge of, you need to be shunned. You cannot be here. And my mom was very much like, the patriarch of the family has spoken and you shall be shunned. And so, yeah, and that was it. And the sad thing is like, after all that happened, this was like April, I was kind of out to my friends, or a couple of my friends, I should say. But I'd still never done anything. But after I had kind of resolved the religious issues in my head and fully left the organization, was comfortable being out of the organization, no longer feared Armageddon and this horrible impending doom, you know, I was like, I'm ready to start my life now. You know, go out there and get a relationship and see what it's like to be gay. And So I started getting more involved in the gay community, that kind of thing, and finally became active in July and loved it. It was the first time I'd ever had, like the first time having sex with a guy was, and you know, I'm not going to get graphic obviously, but it was so natural and so normal and so not what I had experienced with Laura for 18 years. You know, it felt right. It just felt normal to me. I don't really know any other way to put it, but I did finally publicly come out, I think in July via Facebook, which was a big deal because our show, our craft beer show, has quite a large following. And the craft beer community is kind of a man's man's community. You know, it's like it's a bunch of burly dudes that brew beer and yeah. And, okay, you know, through the show, I had become friends with a lot of the brewers in the United States that were doing craft beer that were very well known. And I was very well known in the community. And so I didn't know how people would react to it, but the community has been very accepting, very supportive, and it's been a fantastic experience.
Yeah, I think you should stop and give us a quick description of what this show is you do.
Okay. I do a show weekly called New Brew Thursday. And it's at, we're actually being featured on iTunes right now, which is hilarious. It's, there's a big, huge banner on the front page of the podcast section on iTunes. But basically, the idea of the show came about because a friend of mine was a big Coors Light drinker. It's all he drank was Coors Light. And I wanted him to start to drink craft beer. And the difference between macro and micro beer is, you know, craft is micro. Macro beer would be your Bud Lights, your Coors.
A lot of my audience is Mormon and barely knows what beer is, much
right,
less.
Exactly. So, but there's
so you're basically saying these are small breweries that are doing, you know, specialized beers.
Yeah, it's artisanal.
Artisanal
production.
Beers.
Yeah, artisanal production of beers. Very local, you know, think about like artisanal cheeses, that kind of thing. A lot of connections there. And so the idea for the show was, or the idea for him anyway, was that we'd hang out on Thursday nights all the time because that was the way our schedule worked. And so I told him, like, every Thursday when I come over, I'm going to bring a new beer that you'd never tried before and just try it. Like, you don't have to like it, but just try the beer. And so it was kind of the start of social media, and I was really big on Twitter, and, you know, I really liked being on Twitter. And so I created a Twitter account called New Brew Thursday where I would just tweet a picture of the beer that we were doing each week. And
yeah.
People started following that, and I, you know, wasn't even really paying attention. But we stopped. We didn't stop, but we went on vacation, both of us. Like, he went on vacation 1 week, and then I went another the next week. And so the couple weeks went by where we didn't post any pictures. And people started tweeting at me like, hey, what's the new beer this week? What are you guys drinking? And so I was like, wow, people are actually, like, paying attention to this. And so I had a little, like, video camera, and podcasting was kind of becoming a thing. And I was like, hey, you know, let's record this and record us talking about the beer like we always do. And, you know, nothing specific, and we'll just put it out there. And so me and him and another guy got together, and we started doing these shows once a week where we would just try a beer we'd never had. And we don't review it. We don't, you know, it's like, oh, I give this beer a 98 and blah, blah, blah. Like, we don't do that. We just, if we like the beer, we talk about it on the show. And the show idea is that it's just three buddies getting together and drinking a new beer that they've never had. And, you know, yeah. A lot of times the conversation doesn't even stick to the beer. We go off on tangents and whatever. But
people, now you've got quite a following. How many people are following you?
We average about 30-some thousand per episode and about 400,000 per month.
Wow.
So it's...
And it's kind of a video. It's a YouTube, or is it a
Well, a the majority of our following comes through iTunes. We get like 600 or between 2 and 600 views on YouTube every week. We're not really good for YouTube because our show's too long. It's like 20 some minutes long every week.
Okay.
And the YouTube audience wants everything in 5 minutes or less. We don't get a big following on YouTube, so it's mostly iTunes. All of our traffic comes through iTunes.
Huh. And do you actually somehow make money with this, or is it just all a labor of love?
It's all a labor of love. I mean, we have a couple of sponsors now as of the last couple of months. But generally, we use that to, you know, pay for our trips to... Because every year we go out to Denver for the Great American Beer Festival, which is a five-day thing. And then there's probably four or five events every year that I go to do speaking appearances and that kind of thing for different beer events throughout the country. And so
somehow you became a Jehovah's Witness who became not only a computer programmer, but a beer expert.
A beer expert, yes. it's been an interesting transition the last few years. So
yeah,
and I mean,
well, that's something. Well, you can help me figure out how to promote my podcast so that we can get this podcast out to 30,000.
Well,
that would be.
I'm definitely going to be promoting the link on my side of things, so you might get a bunch of beer listeners that want to hear my crazy religious sexual experience. So.
That will be a change of tune for what they're used to from you. But, yeah, that's cool. Well, so let's sort of return, though, to where you're at. You finally, you know, you've been doing that show for a while, but you came out to them, and you found that this didn't impact negatively your audience there at all. You find it that you could actually have a self-esteem and be a gay man and be outside of Jehovah's Witness and be sexually active. And
and it's been a learning experience for me as well, because I'm a little bit of an extremist in my personality. When I get into something, I get into it really heavily. And so, you know, when I became a gay man and I was out publicly, I think I was a little bit too gay. So, I mean, there a lot of people are very accepting and you know, very supportive, but eventually it was kind of like, dude, we get it, you're gay. There's got to be other parts to your life. And, you know, so for me it was like I dove into it pretty hard, and especially into the bear community. That's a big part of the gay community that I'm involved with. Uh-huh. And now it's like I'm trying to find the ability to kind of balance all of the different parts of who I am so that one's not being overshadowed by the other, and that, you know, I want to find some balance and harmony in the different aspects of my desire to promote craft beer and that industry, my desire to be a computer geek and geek out on computer stuff, and my desire to be a sexually active gay man, you know, that supports uh-huh. the LGBT community and support, you know, I want to support equality. I want to be a part of that drive to change people's viewpoints on the LGBT community as a whole.
Yeah. Do you have aspirations as far as how you want to, what kind of relationships you want to have? Do you see yourself getting in a relationship with someone, or do you like single man who's...
I'm actually in a relationship now. It's long distance. I was initially against the idea of doing a long distance relationship, but we really connected on an emotional level that I wasn't expecting. And he's such a sweetheart and he's such a great guy that I couldn't help but fall for him. We actually started talking in January, first part of January. He came out and spent a week over Valentine's weekend. Spent a week together then. And that was the first time we actually met in person. And we've just kind of gone full barrel. I think the long distance factor of it is good for me because it allows me to get into the relationship side of things as quickly or as slowly as I feel comfortable doing it. There's not a lot of pressure, yeah. You know, like, oh, we're together all the time. Because I think if he lived locally, we'd already be living together. Like, we're already at that stage where, you know, that's a real thing that's going to happen soon. But because he's not here, I'm able to kind of gauge it a little bit more and take my time with it as much as I want to without the pressure of all that right here. But I mean, yeah. I think I'm ready to go the distance with him. And, you know, it's weird to have been married for 18 years. And I can honestly say that I love my ex-wife. She's a great person. If I was given the opportunity to go back and change things, I don't think I would. Uh-huh. Just because I feel like those experiences did kind of define who I was. And it did allow me to have a relationship with somebody who is a really good person. It wasn't the relationship I wanted to have with her, but I would rather have that relationship than none at all. But at the same time, it's weird to have an emotional connection to Cad, who is my guy. What I feel for him, I never felt for her and didn't know that I was capable of feeling. And so it was really confusing at first to fall in love. Yeah. As an adult, you know, like I said, as a kid, I think me and the guy that I got in trouble with as a kid, I think that we were as in love as two adolescents can be. But now as an adult, like, this is a much different experience. It's a much more real experience. And even though we're not together physically, it's the emotional connection is still there. And it's been an awesome situation.
Yeah. Well, I wish you good luck with that. I mean, it's new, so there's a lot of unknown for you yet to explore. But I really hope that, you know, that this works out for you and that it make it happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I'm excited. I'm excited to try to me, it's a good summation of my life is that I spent the majority of my life expecting God to bring Armageddon the next day. And because of my being gay and having what was considered deviant thoughts and deviant actions, I never expected to survive Armageddon. I never thought that God was going to spare me. And so I basically spent my entire life expecting to die the next day. And so now, as a free man, out of the cult, out of my relationship with a woman, able to be who I am and be free and open and public about it and not have to hide it, it's a different experience to look at your life and realize that you have something to live for, that you have the ability to continue living, and that you're not going to be killed the next day by some wrathful God who's decided that you're a horrible example of his creation. And that to me has been the most liberating, emotionally liberating experience that I think I could ever experience.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you one more question then. What are your religious beliefs now?
I am a... I will go with the Douglas Adams response. I'm a radical atheist. I use the word radical because I want people to realize that I'm not agnostic. I don't hold out any idea that there's anything supernatural up there. Certainly not based on any of the holy books that we have available to us. And I hold no religious beliefs, but I do hold some spiritual beliefs.
Uh-huh. Tell me about those.
I believe that... it's a good way to explain this. I think that we resonate on a certain energy level. Each of us resonates at a certain frequency as far as our energy, as far as our makeup goes. And I think that we're attracted to people who resonate on similar frequencies. And that's why we form bonds, human, you know, emotional bonds. And to me, that's a spiritual side of things. Like my compassion, my empathy for humans around me is not guided by a sense of established morality from a supernatural being, but is guided by the fact that there's an energy that resonates through all humans that connects and bonds and ties us all together. And so that we should be trying to connect with each other. We should be trying to understand each other on that kind of a level. And sometimes those frequencies resonate at a stronger level, which creates friendships, which creates relationships, whether they be emotional or sexual or whatever. And I think that when we die, our energy doesn't disappear, but I think it goes back out and we become parts of other people's energies and it's recombined into other things. And you know, not so much of a, not like a reincarnation thing or a resurrection thing, but just a piece of who we are will continue on without us, even if we're not conscious of it. That to me is what I believe as far as any sort of unverifiable, non-scientific viewpoint. That's as close to spirituality as I'll get. But well, I mean, I think the Bible's hooey, and I think organized religion is a means of control, and that's it. I don't think anything positive comes from religion.
Well... after you've told me your experience, it doesn't surprise me that you arrived there, frankly.
Yeah, it's not like I have a lot of fond memories of religion, but you know, I would like to think that my decision and my coming to that level was made out of logic and reason and not a pushback from religion. You know, I don't think I ever really blamed God for my problems. I always believed it was, you know, these individual people that were not following the rules the way they were supposed to. And it was never like, oh, screw you, God. I really wanted to do what God wanted of me. But then my research through the Bible and through science and my logic and my reasons just led me to the point of realizing that I just didn't believe God exists. And so there just wasn't any reason to think about it anymore.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your sharing your story. It's quite a ride.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. You know,
yeah.
I do enjoy discussing my experiences in the religion, and especially from the standpoint of Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, they come across as a very harmless, very, very adorable little religion. You know, oh, look at those guys. They're out, you know, wandering the streets again. And, you know, at most, they're an annoyance. But what people don't realize is that if you're in it and you leave, you lose everything. And, I mean, yeah. I started my life over when I was 36 years old. No friends, no family. Anybody that was a witness that, you know, people that I had been brothers with for 20 years, we don't have a relationship anymore because I left. And, you know, the only thing I regret is that I never was able to come out to my family. And... because by the time I was able to come out publicly, they had already disowned me, and so I never even got the opportunity to tell them.
Yeah. Well, you know, we can only be optimistic that there'll be hopefully some healing there in the future, and I guess if I were you, I wouldn't hold out for that, but just the same, I guess.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to wish just the same.
Yeah, I think about that sometimes, and I realize that what's funny is that, like, if... for some reason, they all were like, one day, like, oh, yeah, you were right. This isn't the true religion, and we don't need to shun you anymore. And, you know, we're really sorry about that. It's going to be like, oh, great. By the way, here's my husband. And I'm gay. So I guess I'll see you later again. You know, I'm not sure how to react to that.
Hopefully, if they do come to that place, it might open up some other possibilities of openness,
yes.
But I guess we can. I may have to check in with you in a few years and update the listeners as to what really happened. Because, you know, you really are just embarking. You're starting your first substantial relationship, hopefully one that can really go forward and maybe even be your D1, and I won't pass judgment now, but, you know, you're new. You're new here, and you're new in this life, and it sounds like you got a lot of great things set up, so you're on a path. But
I'm excited.
I think you've got a lot to discover ahead, and I hope that the vast majority of it is discovering wonderful things, so
I
want to wish
that.
You the best on your journey.
Thank you, Daniel.
Okay.
And thank you for doing the show. This is, I think what you're doing is a great service. So, you know, keep up the
good work. Maybe after you're done with your beer show, you might want to do a parallel podcast like mine and do gay J-Dub stories.
That's an interesting thought. I might have to look into that.
So. Well, it's sure been nice talking to you, and I sure appreciate your taking the time and being willing to share.
Thanks a lot, Daniel. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Clayton Pixton. Check him out at claytonpixton.com.
How kind his precepts are. Come cast your burdens on the Lord and trust his constant His goodness stands approved, unchanged from day to day. I'll drop my breath.